Hello, and welcome back to Millennial 8. This is the seventh night. There are four streams tonight, as usual. In 2 hours, there will be Scott Mannion, and then Vico Hesler, and then Robin Riley. But first, I have Survive the Jive. Tom from Survive the Jive. Tom has been on, I think, most years since 2017, if I recall correctly. And he's obviously a high-profile figure, all-round good chap. Tom, why don't you introduce yourself just to anyone who's ignorant enough not to know who you are?
Thanks for having me back, Colin. By the way, great intro this year. I really like that. I've been on, not every year of the last 8 years, but I was on the first year. I've done at least six, I'd say. I'm a historian. I run a YouTube channel called Survive the Jive, and it's mostly about paganism and like the history of religions, like European religions from before Christianity. And I also, occasionally want to shitpost on the social media channels to wind up lefties when they try to, distort our history. And that has made me a prime target for misinformation and attacks from the academy, from the people in the castle, so to speak. Most of the attacks against me are just made up stuff, but I'm still going. I'm still here, and they really hate me. There's like several, I think two peer-reviewed papers have mentioned me as in academia this year to try as an example of someone, as a white supremacist who's trying to use history to, kill 6 million people or some bullshit. It's completely made up. They base it on a guy in 2019, a guy in a pub after I spoke at an event with you. And then afterwards we went for a drink and there was a little young lad from an aspiring journalist, a graduate from journalism school who later wrote down for Hope Not Hate some things he claims he heard in the pub. And then like peer-reviewed journals now cite that as fact, what he said he heard, which is mostly just made stuff up. So like a teenager made some stuff up. He says he's heard in a pub in 2019. And then the peer review process of academia considers that a source on which to base.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, this is a very good example of what's happened with academia and with the media. I would say Hope Not Hate is more of a media thing than academia. Whatever, lobbying. Hope Not Hate is in turn quoted by the media as a reliable authoritative source.
And by peer-reviewed academic journals as well this year. They're quoting Hope Not Hate, and Hope Not Hate are quoting an unsourced teenager's account of his night in a pub. It's really a sorry state of affairs.
It certainly is. But it leads on to the main topic, which is the distortion, how corrupt academia has become and our whole knowledge apparatus. There's a lot that could be said about that. And I'm not sure how to get into this.
I can say something.
I think the main thing for you is the
peer reviewed journals that mentioned me this year both did so in the context of them. They're both is from academics who are wanting in 2019, the same year that this other stuff with Hope Not Hate happened, a bunch of people tried to ban Anglo-Saxon. It was mostly led by Mary Rambaran-Olm and Eric Wade, but there were others like Helen Young involved. And they hate me so much because I did a live stream on YouTube, which got a lot more attention than anything they've ever done, just saying how stupid and awful it was. And that's why they keep trying to, cite Hope Not Hate and trying to like revive the lies that were invented by Hope Not Hate to try and defame me, because they're just really angry. And they're angry because they haven't been successful in these years of campaigning to ban the word Anglo-Saxon within the academy. Although some newspapers like The Guardian have now got on board with it, and they're reporting on, for example, an Anglo-Saxon cross was found last month. And they did an entire report on it without mentioning the words Anglo-Saxon. So The idea that Anglo-Saxon is a white supremacist term and it has to be not used is absurd. But what really bugged them a lot is that this year came out this huge paper, which basically vindicated what not only what I've been saying, but what historians have been saying for hundreds and hundreds of years, which is that the Anglo-Saxon invasion occurred.
Let's zoom out a bit. I want to sort of lay the scene here, because people tend to think that academia, we want to rely on academia. We want to think that academia is full of people with great honesty, rigor, and not bias, not ideological hang-ups going on, that they are not scientific exactly, but rational, logical, objective, and so on. And do you think that was ever true? I mean, obviously it isn't true today, but was it ever really true? I suspect that for a certain period it basically was true.
I think it's true. I believe in academia. I mean, I believe that anyone who devotes their life to anything, it gets better at it. But, you know, I'd much rather have like a qualified plumber fix my pipes than some guy who just like had a go at it, you know, just recently, because, you know, being qualified and learning how to do things properly and spending a long time in your life doing something makes you good at doing it. And the idea that like learning about history, for example, is any different is just a cope. I know people who are not qualified historians who are extremely knowledgeable and very, you know, competent historians. So I'm not saying that, you know, autodidacts, people outside the academy, aren't capable of being great historians. But generally, for obvious reasons like time constraints, they just aren't. It's not possible to reach the same levels of excellence that the one just devoting all that time to it. Like literally, if you spend hours and hours every day learning about something, you're going to be knowledgeable about it. You're going to be good at it. But also, they have access to resources that you can't get. And a lot of people like to say you can get it's all online now, but that's not true. It's certainly not true. And that's also partly by design. Like some dubious, morally perhaps, academic practices where like certain journals, you know, they're not really widely available. You can only get them inside if you have university access. And also there's old books, you know, old stuff as well, that's just you can get a copy because they were for £5,000 or something like that, you know, because they only printed 200 of them 100 years ago. So it's like there are things like that which being employed by a university or a student of a university gives you access to, and those are valuable. And I it's not my intention to devalue academia or universities. It's only to point out that they have been infiltrated by the far left, and that's bad. It's bad because universities are a good thing. If universities weren't a good thing, it wouldn't matter.
Well, exactly. I mean, academia exists for a reason, and it's the, as you describe, it creates a sort of apparatus, a system for disseminating knowledge, for teaching the skills involved in evaluating facts and evidence. So, I mean, that's why it exists in the first place. So to say that it's worthless or whatever is kind of ridiculous. But the point is that at this stage, it has been very heavily. I mean, I'm continually, and I shouldn't be perhaps, but it's difficult to digest just how bad this corruption is. You hear stuff about even the hard sciences being infiltrated with leftist ideology, which you would think shouldn't be possible, really. But somehow they've managed it. And certainly the social sciences and certainly the arts are completely gone. So I mean, what would you say about that? Because what it seems to mean is that academia, which was once a fairly objective system of knowledge gathering and evaluation, is now basically a political machine.
Well, I don't know. I mean, it can be used as a machine for, you know, generating facts and stuff in certain areas. I mean, we've seen the way that outside my area of expertise a bit, but, you know, the way that the certain facts were manufactured to justify lockdowns and COVID measures and the experimental gene therapy. But
also Cheddar Man would be a good example within your own wheelhouse where something was created, and it's the truth.
I don't think there was anything wrong with the academia behind Cheddar Man. I can go into Cheddar Man, it's a whole other thing, but like it's complicated, but it wasn't just academia there. Like Tom Booth and his team like looked at Cheddar Man, they analyzed, and everybody already knew from other Western hunter-gatherers, which is the population of Western Europe in the Mesolithic, that they didn't have the genes associated with light skin that modern Europeans have. So it was no surprise to find Cheddar Man was the same as all the other skeletons that have been looked at in that respect. And I'd already talked about this on my channel long before the Cheddar Man fiasco, a good year before at least. But he then, you know, took that, they did a skin projection, a prediction of like a range of colors it could be. And Tom Booth is notoriously left-wing, you know, anti-British, kind of, you know, anti-white. And he, you know, went to outside the academia. The reconstruction is not done by any university. It's done by something, it's outside. He, with them, went for the darkest possible complexion. And then the media took it. And then people like Afua Hirsch, race baiter, started calling him an African. Like the Natural History Museum and Tom Booth would never have ever said that he was African. They would never go that far. That would be ridiculous. In fact, in the video that they did about that reconstruction of Cheddar Man, they specifically said, he is not African, not African. They wanted to make that absolutely clear. So it's like, it's not just, the academia is not as bad as the media in this case. It was the media and the reconstruction were the problem with Tom Booth. I think
the way this arrived in the public consciousness was, he's dark, therefore he's African. And it doesn't matter that someone somewhere is saying, no, he's definitely not African. The way that this was made to arrive in the public consciousness was, well, that means he was really African. So all these white people claiming that Britain was white are wrong.
That's because of the media, not because of the original paper. That's not because of the academics who sequenced Cheddar Man's DNA. Except with the exception of Tom Booth, maybe he was the way he worked with the media, maybe was in collusion, but he would still never have actually ever put in, you know, his name on anything that said that Cheddar Man was African, because he'd have been a laughing stock. But he would, you know, he's happy to see that the media do that. He doesn't mind. I know, because Afua Hirsch, Tom Booth, and Aaron Rutherford all were arguing me on Twitter in 2018 about this stuff. They were getting angry with me, but they weren't getting angry with the thousands and thousands of black people who were saying, oh, he was an African, he was black. They don't mind when people are wrong, really, really wrong, if they're wrong in a certain way.
Exactly. They were annoyed with you for being right, effectively.
At me for being white.
But that sort of underlines what I was saying at the start, that it seems that academia is now not as interested in the truth as it once was, or at least that there's a heavy bias towards seeing things the way they want to see them. What would you say about that?
Yes, of course, but it's not necessarily because, like as you said earlier, the academia was a machine. I wouldn't go that far. I'd say it's just because. And I think, what's his name? Nima
Parvini.
Yeah. He's talked about how like there's not this sort of the way that there's the establishments, like the power structures are all interlinked, because there's a shared culture. So it doesn't matter that you don't have to have this inbuilt, institutionalized anti-white leftism in universities to make them ideologically inclined to that way, because that's the overall climate in the schools. That's the overall climate on the media. That's the overall climate in pop culture, on all the bands that they've been raised listening to, everything. So that when students who take, you know, if you raise people in that culture and then you give them a position of power in academia, it's not like they suddenly magically become, you know, a Victorian professor or something. They don't.
Oh, yeah.
So that's the source, in my opinion, of this bias. It's not from, if there's institutional bias, it's just because there's too many people who think back this way. But anyway, that may be beside the point. But like this paper, can we go back to the Anglo-Saxon paper that came out this year? This really pissed them off. This pissed off a lot of people because basically there's been this huge thing, like not just this Ban Anglo-Saxon paper. That's another thing. Like, I mean, Ban Anglo-Saxon is a very fringe group of very far left academics. Most historians don't agree. And that's why in 2019, after I did my stream, and they argued, these lefties argued that it was influenced by me, but I don't know if it was. They were just saying it was influenced by me to discredit the academics who then signed a petition, loads of them all saying, don't ban Anglo-Saxon, that's stupid. Including, most of these academics signing the petition are left-wing as well. Like, left-wing academics aren't all completely insane. Rambo and Ulm is. But there is a more general, a much older thing in academia to deny the Anglo-Saxon phenomenon as an invasion, as an invading race of people dominating another and replacing them to some extent. That's been controversial since about the Second World War. And that entire, not just that, but all narratives of invasion, including Indo-European and Aryan invasions, have become extremely controversial. And then in recent years, with the rise of the genomic revolution since 2015, mainly, and all these papers that I've been covering on my channel, there's been this uproar in the humanities that have really like set a lot of archaeologists, historians, people in the humanities in general on edge, because it's basically made them all look like fools, because it's shown that all these things that gray-haired white men in the 19th century used to say are true, and that they hate that because they've been feeling morally and intellectually superior to those people for so long. In short, I've done a big stream like unpacking the whole Anglo-Saxon paper for an hour on my Jive Talk channel. But the short of it is, the Anglo-Saxon invasion did happen, and every single person in Britain, in England at least, including even Cornwall, has a minimum of 25% Anglo-Saxon DNA and a maximum of about 50%, 47%. So you are, if you're English, you're between a quarter and half from these Nordic Germanic invaders, which come from pretty much the exact places we've always thought they came from. So Northern Germany and Denmark, and a little bit from Southern Sweden as well, which we didn't know about that so much. So that's really cool. But it also showed, which we didn't know, is that actually not all the invaders were Anglo-Saxons. England is not just a mixture of Iron Age Celt and Anglo-Saxon, but it's actually a three-way mix. And this was difficult for a lot of people to swallow, between Anglo-Saxon, British Celt, and French. The French, they admit, I know it's terrible to say, but the French is that French migration that says begins with the Anglo-Saxon times, and then that will be Franks, which are Germanicized French people who, they've adopted a Germanic culture and they're coming with the Germanic migrations. But then it continues. Most of the French DNA we have didn't come at the same time as the Anglo-Saxons. Most of it came during the Middle Ages, when a lot of France was English and the aristocracy here was speaking French. And we were basically like very integrated with France in the High Middle Ages. We had books in French and everything. So that's not a huge surprise if you know history, but it's interesting because we don't consider that as part of our DNA. Some people point out that some people in English look a bit Southern, like some people look a bit like French people, basically, don't they? That's why. So it's basically varies. You can be as little as 11% Iron Age Britain. So that's the lowest that you can have. The least amount of native Celt you can have as an Englishman is 11%. And the least amount of Anglo-Saxon is 25%. So overall, you could say we're probably more Anglo-Saxon than we are Celt. But then there's this French thing as well, which is significant.
So what did the term Anglo-Saxon, why is it controversial? Is it because what did it refer to? What has it been used to refer to in the past? Why is it now a controversial term?
Well, I did a big talk on this in London last Christmas for the Traditional Britain group. And basically, it's controversial because I mean, it isn't actually controversial. As I said, it's only this fringe people. But Anglo-Saxon was used in Anglo-Saxon times, but it wasn't the only term used. And most of the written sources we have in Anglo-Saxon England are not in Old English. They're in, although many are in Old English, they're often in Latin. So we're talking often in translating things. So sometimes we're called gentis Anglorum, which would mean the English race. Sometimes in Old English, it would say Anglish, which is basically English. So, and sometimes Anglo-Saxon. And the term Anglo-Saxon means exactly the same thing as English. It doesn't have any other meaning at that time, at the actual Anglo-Saxon times. Over time, though, it did change quite a lot. And because these lefties were trying to say, Eric Wade and Rambour and Ohm were saying that actually Anglo-Saxon was hardly used at all in the Anglo-Saxon times, which isn't true. It was used quite a few times. And then they say that it wasn't used for hundreds of years. And I gave examples in the talk where it was used in the Middle Ages. They tried to claim that in the Middle Ages it wasn't in use, but it was. And
just to interrupt you briefly, I've just looked up Eric Wade on Twitter. His bio is queer medievalist researching the global origins of ideas about sex and race in medieval English literature. I mean, for heaven's sake, it even sounds highly ideological.
They're activists. They're not historians, they're activists. Anyway, why are they focusing on the term Anglo-Saxon? They say it's racist. And the reason they say it's racist is nothing to do with the fact that they say it hasn't actually been used enough in the Anglo-Saxon times or that it was not used enough in the medieval times. I mean, it really rose to, they're right to say it really became a prominent and important thing in the early modern era, in the 16th century and onwards. And they point out that in America, it was used as a racial term to refer to basically white people. And therefore, they say because America was racist and they used that term, therefore the term is racist. It's a really tenuous link, but they want to completely ban its use all over the place. And some of the other left-wing academics who were fought against them said, look, it might be racist in its use in America, but it wasn't racist in its use in England. And the alternative that the lefties were suggesting was early English. They want to call the Anglo-Saxon era the early English era. And I said in my stream in 2019, I don't actually object to early English because the Anglo-Saxons, the term English was used interchangeably with the term Anglo-Saxon even back then. And I think it just means the same thing anyway. We're the same people. It's not so in that sense, it enforces that idea of the continuity of the English ethnic group. And then some of the lefties who were against the ban said, English Defense League uses the word English in a what they call a racist term. So why do you prefer that? It doesn't actually have any consistent ideology behind it, but they're just focusing on, they want to ban Anglo-Saxon for whatever reason. And they've got this, fixation. So the funny thing I pointed out also in the traditional Britain group talk is that the majority of the uses of Anglo-Saxon over the last 1,000 years have been really quite in a progressive sense. So in the 14th century, there's an anonymously titled book called about Athelstan, the Anglo-Saxon king, and Chaucer mentions some Anglo-Saxon gods, Anglo-Saxon figures like Wade, that's an Anglo-Saxon god. I don't know if that's got any relation to Eric Wade, but there's stuff like that in the Middle Ages. It wasn't actually used a lot in the Middle Ages, but that makes sense because there's a French, Norman descended elite who are trying to suppress Anglo-Saxon identity. But after the 16th century, when we become Protestants, we try to re-establish this Germanic idea. And also it's it gets tied with a bit of a kind of idea of an old England of liberty and freedom that existed before the Norman conquest. And these values are in keeping with Protestant values. And this imagined Anglo-Saxon past before the Normans is used as a way of shoring up identity for Protestant England against the Catholics in the South. And that's kind of, I mean, it's not really true. A lot of the stuff they talked about, it was all about how free everyone was in Anglo-Saxon times. And some people still talk like that. And The Guardian even has done several articles in recent years saying how people with Norman names own more than people with Anglo-Saxon names or something. So it's like a kind of proto-socialist sentiment that goes back a long way and is actually not really based on anything real, because the Anglo-Saxons were not egalitarian in any sense of the word. They were very hierarchical, just like the Normans were. But the paper is cool because it shows that, the post-war stuff about Anglo-Saxons not being real is bullshit. And we do really have this constant Anglo-Saxon identity, even if it's sometimes been tied to extremist Protestant ideas or whatever. It's our identity, and it is the same thing as English. And we do have this. And, Queen Victoria had, there's a statue made of Queen Victoria and Albert dressed as Anglo-Saxons in the Victorian era. So it's like we imagined ourselves in this way, and we idealized this root of our country, of our nationhood, of our ethnogenesis with the Anglo-Saxons, to the extent that we have statues of Alfred. Rule Britannia refers to Alfred. Like the Anglo-Saxon era is the origin of England. And that's part of the reason I like to focus on it, because I feel that if I can convince people in England to be proud of that, then they should be proud of everything that came after, because that's the start of England as a nation, as a people.
Yeah. I would suspect that if this fringe group of academics did succeed in eradicating the concept of Anglo-Saxon, they would then proceed to eradicating the concept of ancient Celt, for example, or something like that. There's a meme that went around. There are actually several versions of it. But there was a, let me see if I can find it now. It's one of those memes that I've always found extremely useful. Let me just see if I've still got it. No, I'm not sure if I have, but basically it's this idea of the sort of smug, well, actually guy, dismantling identity stage by stage, because there is no end to it.
I know the one you mean. It's like, there's no such thing as Anglo-Saxons. They're a mixture of Anglo-Saxons and Saxons. Oh, there's no such thing as early. They're a mixture of Neolithic farmers.
There it is. See, I mean, this is amazing. And I've seen this. I mean, I've literally handed this meme to people when they're in a debate like this on Twitter. They come and moan in my group about it, and I give this meme to them, and it's like, oh wow, that's exactly what's happening. So the top
they
level
could that, they could do that for literally any people on earth. Like when if some loggers chopping down an Amazonian people's home and they say we're native, we'll say, what do you mean native? You came here from Siberia. No one's native anywhere. Like, you could do that to anyone, but they wouldn't do that such a thing. They only do it to us because, there is no consistency except hate white people. It's just an ideology of pure hatred, and there's nothing consistent except hatred. So it's fun to point out their hypocrisy, but I've never seen them like actually acknowledge it.
This is why this meme is good, because it forces, in theory at least, it would force them to acknowledge it. They'd have to, you show them what they're doing, what are they going to say to that? If I were still on Twitter and if I had a shitposter account, this is what I would just be showing this to people and then walking away. Because what is the point of getting into it with someone who is this stupid?
Yeah. I mean, I think it's really important because for us in Britain, because Englishness is the most, I think, of all white identities in the world, actually, the one that is probably the most hated is English, because it's the one that's most global, the one that was the most, successful in the colonial ventures, not the one that was most vicious. We didn't enslave as many as the Iberians did. We didn't reach new ground as fast as the Portuguese did. So we weren't the most brutal as the Belgians were in Africa. So it's not that we were more cruel. It's not that we oppressed people more. It's just that we were more successful, that we ended up winning. That's why they hate us. They hate us because we won and we're good at things. And actually, I mean, I'm not pro British Empire necessarily, but I'm definitely not pro being anti British Empire. But I definitely think that, like, it's one of the most benign empires that's ever existed. Like, if I had to be if I had to be reincarnated at some point in history as a subjugated person from by another empire, I definitely want to be subjugated by the British, not by, you know, the Ottomans or like the Mongols or someone. Like, if you get your head or something else chopped off, and that would be the end of it.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I've got mixed feelings about the empire. It's all sort of historic now. It doesn't, or I should say historical at this point. It's not something that I think, I mean, when we were kids, I think it was still more in the air than it is now. I think it was even then, like in the 80s, late 80s, it was still something that, like, your grandparents had really remembered it. Even your parents could, like, growing up in the 50s and 60s, it was still very much a part of their mental furniture. So you sort of absorbed it as a small child then. But I think now it's not only been eradicated, not only gone, but it's very much replaced with the new, you might fancifully call a new empire of globalism. That seems like the rainbow flag. That seems to have really taken root and become people's mental furniture today.
It's true. I mean, my grandfather used to talk about he was a toddler at India, so he remembers being in colonial India. And I talked to him when I was playing Sonic the Hedgehog in the 90s on my Mega Drive. My grandpa trying to tell me about his childhood in India. I wish I'd listened more to him and less to Sonic the Hedgehog. But the divide, the cleave between these generations. Like, I was being given this, like, tawdry crap instead of like the heritage that is what was ours to learn about. But there was one thing in that paper that I didn't talk about in my stream, and I wanted to talk about it now because I think that it's going to be a huge story next year, which is the Up-Down Girl. I'm not talking about the song by Billy Joel. I'm talking about one of the skeletons they found, which was not a big part of the paper because the paper was all about Anglo-Saxons in general, but she's a 10-year-old girl from a 7th century cemetery, Christian cemetery, so not my area. I prefer pagan stuff. And, she's 10 years old in a family cemetery, no barrows, nothing, no interesting pagan stuff, just like ditch. She's got a ditch burial. And they said, is a quarter black and three quarters Anglo-Saxon. She's in the same cemetery. Two of her aunts, her great aunts, have 100% Anglo-Saxon ancestry, meaning that I'm not saying Anglo-Saxon as in Anglo-Saxon, like late Anglo-Saxon means a mixture of Britain and invading Germanic, but these people were mostly pure Germanic invaders and continental ancestry, basically. So she's continental ancestry, three quarters continental ancestry, and a quarter Yoruba related. And Yoruba is a tribe in Nigeria that's used as a proxy for geneticists to just see, like, general West sub-Saharan African ancestry. And in case you're not aware, nearly all the black people that, have proliferated in the world are of sub-Saharan West African descent, including African-Americans and Afro-Caribbeans and Africans in South America as well. And therefore, if you meet someone of whether they're in Britain, whether they're Nigerian or they're of Afro-Caribbean descent, or you see African-Americans on television, you're really seeing people from quite a small portion of African ancestry, which is the coastal region of Western sub-Saharan Africa. And that's the same area where this girl has a quarter of her ancestry, and it is impossible to explain. And so they're going to do another paper. Already the media are gloating over it. The Daily Mail did an article gloating about this, saying, the blacks, this and that. But the
just to summarize before you move on, have you any idea, or have they any idea of the age of these remains?
Like, what age?
What period they're from?
Seventh century. That's second half of the 7th century. So the late 600s, by which point there were still pagans around in England, but the process of Christianization was quite well underway. And this was very much, this is the latest cemetery at Updown in Eastry in Kent. And for those who aren't aware, Kent is in the southeast part of England, adjacent to France. So this is like the entrance to Britain. And all these, that's why these people are so foreign. Like they all have a lot of continental ancestry, a lot of French ancestry, a lot of Germanic ancestry, Nordic ancestry, not very much British ancestry. And it's possible there's no other people, there's no like black person in the grave. Like the guy who she got, this 10-year-old girl got, she actually says, they say she's 33% black. And they say that, you know, you can't actually be 33% black. She's, that would mean she's got one, she's 25, because you can have, you know, like you're 25% your granny, you know, you say you're 25% your granny, but actually you don't get exactly 25% from one of your grandparents. You get 50% from each parent. But then which parts you get from each parent is random. So you can get,
I mean, this is how I'm not 25% Italian, right? It's I'm like 7% or something for that reason.
Well, that you got an unusually low amount of Italian. Like that's a freakishly low amount to have from having one Italian pure grandparent. And she got an unusually large amount. So she went, instead of getting 25%, she got 33%. But you can say she's 25, but she's going to have a black grandpa because it's not from the maternal side. And and the two aunt, great aunts that are in the grave with her have no black ancestry. So the blacks aren't there. The blacks are somewhere else. Did she pick this up on the continent? Who knows? The only black ancestry we know about that's in Europe, anywhere in Europe at that time, is coming from the Moors. And we've done, there's some Moorish cemeteries in Iberia at the time. But despite what some Afrocentrists may have you believe, the Moors were not, strictly speaking, black. In fact, there were more white Moors than there were black Moors in Spain. The Moorish cemetery that's been analyzed has a mixture of people. Like most of them are like a mixture of like Middle Eastern, black, and white. There are, but the in Spain, I'm talking about the Moors in Spain specifically. In Africa, the Moors had less white ancestry. But basically, a lot of a Moor originally was an ethnic group of Middle Easterners, but they enslaved white people and they enslaved black people. And then if you are in Islam, if you're a slave and you convert to Islam, you can be freed. So there's a massive incentive once you've been enslaved to convert to Islam. And then once you've been freed, you go around with the Moors enslaving other people. And it, you know, so then when we see a boat full of Moorish people coming to enslave you, you'll see black faces, white faces. And the Icelanders who were enslaved by Moors, because some Moors went all the way to Iceland, this is later, they said the worst of the Moors were probably of English descent. So there were some English people who got kidnapped by the Moors, converted to Islam, and then said, I know a place you can go. It's called Iceland. You can get more slaves there. Probably trying to stop them going to England. And then they went there. But there were also blacks. And then the black people would be the most distinct to look at. So sometimes people would exaggerate the features of the blacks and say blackamoors, because they would be the most shocking to see. But what we see in the cemeteries is that the Moors, you don't find any pure blacks. You only find them mixed. So they've got Middle Eastern ancestry, because even in North Africa, there are no Yoruba people. Like there are no people from Nigeria in North Africa, let alone in Spain, with the Moorish, in Moorish Spain and Andalusia or whatever. So what's odd with Updown Girl is she's not like a quarter Moor, which would mean she had a bit of North African ancestry, a bit of Arab ancestry. She's got no Middle Eastern ancestry, no North African ancestry at all. She's just got Nordic DNA and black DNA, like as in deep, dark sub-Saharan African DNA from somewhere like Nigeria. And there's no way we can explain that at present, because there's no example of any population like that anywhere in Europe, let alone as far north as Kent. So it's a bit shocking. And my first instinct was to say this is a mistake, because I can't think of a way to explain it. The only explanation I could think would be Moors, but if we can't use more as an explanation, I can't think of another explanation, because there were no like long traveling Nigerian merchants in those times that we know about. Like they would have to be using other people's trade routes and other people, you know, traveling along with Moors or something. But apparently it's not a mistake. And it doesn't seem very likely that they've made a mistake, and they claim that they've accounted, you know, for the risk of contamination, which is sometimes in DNA studies a problem where, you know, one of the people testing some of their skin gets in it or whatever, and you know, that would explain it. But I don't know how to explain it, but let's say it's true for the sake of argument. That's really crazy and shocking. But she's an outlier. She wasn't representative of the population of England.
Of course. I mean, I was just going to say, let's say it's true. Because big deal. It doesn't, like, it's one person from a population of God knows how many. I mean, so what? I think this goes to this is actually indicative of how fatuous our thinking has become, that we think one single exception negates the whole idea of an ethnic group or a culture existing. I think it's ridiculous that we're even making so much fuss about this. I mean, if there were loads of them around, then that would be a completely different thing. But the fact that they've searched and searched and searched and searched and searched and eventually found one person who was a third black.
A quarter black. Yeah.
Who cares? I mean, imagine jumping on that. Imagine being so desperate to negate the fact of a group's identity that you would find one example and make a huge deal out of it. I just think this is absolutely absurd.
I remember, like, was it BT Headwoman? She was listed as one of the greatest black Britons. And this is a Roman era black woman that was found in Sussex. And then they did DNA. They were talking about how she was black for years and years and years, and using her as an example of ancient presence of blacks in Britain. They finally did a DNA test and they found she had zero black ancestry. They didn't announce, they whispered that announcement. They'd been BBC having all over the website on the greatest black Briton. She was so great just because she happened to be black, apparently because of the shape of her skull. But the skull measurements aren't 100% reliable in determining someone's race. They can be useful, but certainly not very useful on in all cases. But in this case, she's going to be the new Beachy Head Woman, because they're like, but you know, they won't shut up about when they find something that they can use to undermine native identity. But when they realize that they've been lying or they've been grossly in error, they don't admit it. They don't like to, you know, publicly retract anything.
Of course, the undermining will be on page one, the front cover. The retraction will be on page 50. And no one will ever hear about it. I mean, this is why people still rave about Cheddar Man now. Like, the normie conception of Cheddar Man is that he was black.
Yeah, even though there was a retraction, there was even like, you know, for Cheddar Man, a lot of academics were saying, no, we don't know his complexion. And we certainly know he definitely was not a black man. He was not an African. There's no way he was an African, but whatever his complexion was. And then the question of his complexion is still, you know, open. We don't have a reliable way of determining his complexion. The Hirosplex software that's used is not 100% reliable. You know, they're already, the big paper will come on this, and then from that you'll get all the media reaction. So, because this Daily Mail article that came out on Up Down Girl was just like a preliminary one. And now, like, Duncan Sayre, who is the guy who was given her sample by the museum, is going to be involved in a whole big, she's getting a whole study on her. Why? She's not significant for the Anglo-Saxon era. She's not like important at all. And the initial media reports on her saying how she had a high status burial. What do they think a high status burial is? Do you want to know what she was buried with? She had a spoon, she had a fork, and she had a pot. You call that high status? Like, she's a really high status woman. She got a bloody spoon. Like, they're just reaching. Like, they want to say, even though she was quarter black, they still considered her really valuable enough to give her a spoon.
So that in turn means that black people were prominent in.
Yeah, they were prominent. That's what they're going to make out. They're like, they're a big shot. She was walking around, spoons, Potts in the big shot 10-year-old girl. Oh my God.
Have there been other examples? Because I remember asking you once about, I think it was Norfolk Man or Norwich Man or something that they thought was black.
I can't remember. There was Ivory Bangle Lady, and there hasn't been a DNA test for her yet, as far as I'm aware. They claim she's black. I mean, actually, you know, of the ancient black Britons, and by ancient, I'm using the term ancient. To me, Anglo-Saxon is not ancient. That's the medieval period. So ancient to me means Roman and earlier. There has never been a single skeleton found with a single drop of black blood anywhere in Britain that has been tested. There are several that have been speculated to have been black because of the shape of the skull, but those that have been tested have been proven not to be black. So that doesn't mean there definitely were black people in Roman Britain, but there's never been any archaeological evidence of them. The evidence that they were here is in the Roman records because the Romans employed black soldiers, and we know like Septimus Severus. Was a North African, not black. Septimus Severus was a North African soldier who sometimes, general, and he's sometimes listed as like a black African, even though he's one of the reasons we know there were black people in Roman Britain, because he was racist against them. Because he when he encountered an Ethiopian, by the way, Ethiop means burnt skin in Greek. And they just used that to mean anyone south of the sub-Saharan. They didn't just mean like what we now call Ethiopia. So anyone with black skin was an Ethiop. And the Ethiopian soldier, he saw him and he was like, "Whoa, that's a bad omen." And he got really scared that he saw a person with a soldier with black skin. And he was worried, therefore, that he would be, you know, not victorious in battle against the Britons because of the presence of this dark omen. Now, if that one shows that he was not black, because he wouldn't have reacted that way. He was a North African, something like an Arab, but not an Arab, but, you know, North Africans, whatever you want to call them. And also shows that where he grew up, there weren't people that looked like that either. So also it shows that in Roman Britain, you didn't see a lot of those people, because otherwise he wouldn't have been so shocked and considered it an omen. But there were some. And
exactly.
They didn't stick around, and they didn't have any significance to the history of Britain.
Yeah, of course not. I found the thing. It was not Norfolk or Norwich. It was Ipswich. That's what I was getting mixed up with. Apparently, in a graveyard in Ipswich, there has been found a man who was North African, born between 1190 and 1300. And, you know, I just think, so what? You know, they get all excited about this. I mean, it's pathetic. It shows how desperate they are to negate this whole thing.
And it's funny that, you know, they don't do it for all. I mean, like, I'm against mass migration. I'm against like the replacement of indigenous people in their native lands. And it's funny though that of all the different people that are coming here, there's like, and blacks are by no means the largest number that are coming at all. We have huge numbers of people from South Asia, huge numbers of people from Middle Eastern countries and from Eastern Europe. But none of those people, and also from East Asia, like China, like Hong Kong, whatever. But none of those people are like trying to insert themselves anachronistically into our history. It's only black people, strangely, or if not actually, to be fair to blacks, not always them is doing it. It's white people doing it on their behalf, but
are often mixed race people. I mean, like Afua Hirsch and the Barat woman. I've forgotten her name now. I'm fairly sure she's mixed. What's her name again? The woman you mentioned earlier, Barat.
Afua Hirsch.
No, the other one.
Mary Rambaran Om.
Mary Rambaran. Oh, yes. Let's see. Yeah, she is. I mean, it's cruel. And I've got nothing. I don't want to hurt people who are mixed race or offend them or whatever. But it does seem to be quite consistent that there seems to be a high preponderance of mixed race people who have an inclination, a very strong inclination, to negate the concept of ethnic identity because they don't have a solid one themselves. So they don't want other people to have one.
That another example of that is the, you know, the BBC's go-to genetics expert, Adam Rutherford, who is a, if I may say so, a prick. To be honest, I really don't like him. But he's, I think, of mixed race or something. But he obviously it doesn't like that he can't participate in the native identity in the same way that most people do.
Yes, and he's half Guyanese Indian.
Yeah.
So there you go. Sorry to interrupt.
No, well, just making the, you know, reinforcing the point you made that some people of mixed ancestry feel the need to invalidate the value of not being of mixed ancestry, which is sad and, you know, speaks for itself, doesn't it?
It is, but it's something that they have. I mean, in a sane world, they would just come to terms with that. You know, they'd say, okay, it's not the end of the world that I don't have a solid ethnic identity. It's, it doesn't make my existence any less valid.
No.
But I think in a highly febrile, politicized age like ours, they go the opposite route and they feel really paranoid about it. And and there's that whole apparatus waiting to utilize their frustration.
He's been hugely rewarded. You know, you get, what did they get? They get articles in the newspapers, like Guardian giving Rambo an arm, like, you know, quoting her, the BBC getting Adam Rutherford all the time. There's many, many accomplished geneticists besides him who would like to have, you know, say things, but he gets to be the guy on the BBC. They want someone, the media wants someone who they know will mouth the correct platitudes. And these people will dutifully dance to that tune.
Yeah, and I should emphasize, you know, we're not saying that mixed race people shouldn't get into this stuff. We're just noting that there seems to be a high preponderance of them who
certainly
have a bias.
Nothing of the kind, yes. I never said anything against people of mixed race or that they shouldn't be in academia. But I don't think anyone should try to undermine or belittle other people's ancestry or try to, undermine the notion of identity of an indigenous people to justify their replacement by mass migration, which is what's being done.
Yeah, yeah. It seems to be something that's come over from America. And I'm not, you know, just to be clear, I'm not having a go at Americans here. But there was a thing in like the 2000s, in the 90s, where Americans would discover that they had some Native American DNA or they had a tiny amount of black DNA or something. And so it became a thing in America to say, well, have you looked at before you moan about immigration, have you looked at your own DNA? Have you looked into your own ancestry? Because there might be something there that negates this idea that you're white. And then that seems to have now been transposed across the Atlantic to ancient European countries where there's much less of a preponderance of this stuff. But I've seen people saying this, well, have you looked into your own ancestry? Do you know that you're 100% this Nordic Ubermensch? Because that's what they think. Yes, that's their caricature.
They watched Jerry Springer where the KKK guy finds out he's black or whatever. And then,
precisely. And that, like, that kind of thing. Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But it's much less prevalent in the old world still. I mean, obviously, that's going to change.
Even though I shouldn't add that the average white American is less than 1% non-European.
Yeah.
So that's
it's a tiny thing. It's America, not something
like,
that's.
If you identify as white and you're American, you're probably more than 99% white, probably, although there are exceptions. But it's not like, you know, they're all a mix. It's just not really the case. Actually, globally, I think it was something very interesting. Like, I can't remember. I wish I could remember the exact stat, but it was something like 99% or 95% of people who are exactly the same race that they identify as. So if
what race
they identify as, and then do DNA tests, they're the same race. Only a very few people who are in like places where like, you know, like countries like Mexico or the Caribbean, where people are, or like Brazil, where people are really confusingly mixed. Like you get people who are like majority black, but call themselves white and stuff like that. But in normal countries, that doesn't happen.
From memory, it was more like 98 or 99%. I remember this thing. It was a few years ago. I used to cite it quite a lot. And this idea that people like that it's difficult to know what black means, or it's difficult to know what white means. We don't really know. We're all using these terms differently. That's a psyop. That's a gaslighting sort of thing. It's bullshit. Mm. We all know what these terms mean. Just instinctively, you pick it up in the ether. And yeah, most people do use them in a consistent way. What you think of as white, the DNA analysis will also think of as white. Time and time and time again, I'm sure it was like 99.5% or something like that. So it's just absurd. Again, more of this dishonesty. I mean, there's a lot that can be said there, but I think it's sad that intelligent people nowadays so often engage in trying to prove how intelligent they are by believing things they must know are bullshit. And
on the other side, I do believe, at least in Devon, I get the impression that the common man just doesn't fall for this bullshit. I really think that, like, they know that, like, when they hear this stuff, it's not true. Like, or maybe they sometimes raise their eyebrows and say, well, when the up-down girl thing happens, maybe people will say, oh, I didn't know there were black Anglo-Saxons then. But they don't really, they'll carry on as normal, you know. But it has to be constantly beating over the head. Like, whites don't matter. Whites aren't a thing. Whites aren't real. But also you should be guilty. You should feel bad about being white. And you should give us more money to, you know, atone for being white. And
And you should definitely race mix. constant pressure to do that.
The ads at least say that.
Yes, but then there's also this stuff like, it's healthier, they've got more immunity and all that, the hybrid vigor, which turned out to be a load of rubbish. It's amazing how much of this there is.
Where are they? I know that I've heard people say that on the internet, but are they pushing that on in the media or something? I didn't know.
I have seen it in the media, rarely, but it's something that people say, like ordinary people say, you'll see it on Twitter and whatever. But I have definitely seen it and I can't recall where now, but I've definitely seen it in people because then, you know, the people who are on TV, they've seen it on Twitter. So then they repeat it on air. So
hybrid vigor.
Yeah, it's something that apparently is there in plants, but it doesn't actually apply to mammals.
Well, yeah, I mean, I don't know the exact details. Hybrid vigor is a thing, but then so is outbreeding depression. So,
What I read was that it is something that has been found in plants, where if you mix two species, they have somehow the stronger genes get selected and so on. Mm-hmm. But in mammals, this has never been observed. So the idea that and it's to do with that. It's also backed up by the fact of African genes being dominant and European genes being recessive. So they'll say, well, it's the stronger genes. So that in turn is used to encourage black people to feel better because they've got stronger genes, stronger.
Interestingly, that only applies with West Africans. With East Africans, if someone of European descent has a child with someone of East African, the children end up looking quite European. The European genes are more dominant against like an Ethiopian or a Somalian, for example. It's not the same effect as when you see with a West African. But
I didn't know that.
Yeah, it's a funny genetic phenomenon. I don't think makes any difference to anything.
No. All right, well, we'll get to the super chats then. There are several. So, okay. Has STJ encountered claims by gypsies and certain Irish travellers of claiming descent from an Egyptian princess? Plausible or done for effect? I've never heard of this.
I think you're mixing up two distinct and unrelated things there. The first is that the Roma gypsies in Elizabethan times in England used to describe themselves as Egyptians, hence why we call them gypsies. And this was because they could, the Egyptian culture at the time had a value in terms of like magic. So if they were selling, you know, crystal ball stuff, it would be useful for them. And the Egyptians Act passed by Queen Elizabeth I to get rid of these people, she refers to them as the people who refer to themselves as Egyptians, implying that we knew full well that they weren't Egyptians. But those are Roma gypsies. And what must be understood is that Roma gypsies, who now from genetic studies we know originate not in Egypt, but in India, low-caste people who left India and hit the road and mixed with Middle Easterners and then with Eastern Europeans to make the modern Roma genome. They are completely unrelated from Irish travelers. Irish travelers hit the road after Cromwell devastated Ireland, and some of the people who moved from the land just hit the road at that point. They are completely Irish genetically. They're not a separate race from the Irish in any sense, except for the fact that rather like Ashkenazi Jews, they have ceased to breed with the general populace and have kept their genes, like they only breed with each other. So that in that sense, the Irish travelers have made themselves a separate genetic group or a separate caste within Ireland. The idea that there was a Scottish princess, I'm sorry, an Irish princess in... an Egyptian princess in Ireland comes from a medieval, I can't remember which medieval monk was writing, some medieval scholar wrote a nonsense account of trying to explain the origin of the Scotti, who were an Irish tribe who invaded Scotland and gave it the name Scotland, saying that they were named after an Egyptian princess called Scotta. It's bullshit. There's no evidence that this ever happened. It's possible someone somewhere has confused these two separate things and mixed them together. So because they've not understood that Irish gypsies and Roma gypsies are not related in any way. Hope that answers the question.
All right. Let's see, there are quite a few here. This is from Based Pagan. Tom, I took up your offer with MyHeritage and managed to trace back my family to the 14th century. No Mozarts or Michelangelos, but every man jack of them significant to me. I'm ashamed to say I waited 47 years. I raise an ale to you and my ancestors and honour their memory. That's really nice.
Well, I'm glad you did that, yeah. Yeah, I've used a different... service myself for the last 10 years or so to research it, but I found that the researching one's ancestry, one's family tree, is very rewarding and very interesting and grounding, and helps you to connect with, you know, who you are, where you come from. And I often like think about those kind of things to try and like put everything into context. Like when things are tough, you know, think about the hardships that your ancestors went through. And if you've got to do something difficult, remember the great people that you descend from and that you can do great things as well.
All right. I certainly agree with that. I would second all of that. Tolland Mann says, did the Norse ceremony Sonargolter directly inspire the Boar's Head Carol ceremony? And can Tom give us a verse?
Oh, well, the Jolly Heretic sang the whole thing because he can remember the Latin. I'm not so good with the Latin, but the boar's head, as I understand, it's the finest dish in all the land. That's enough. Anyway,
I was just getting into it there. Thank you for that. That was very nice.
No problem. The answer to the question, maybe, I think possibly. I wrote a blog on my blog that I think yes, but it does come from that, but there's absolutely no way to connect it. Like in Scandinavia at Christmas, they make julgris, like little marzipan pigs, And the Wikipedia page will tell you that it relates to this. By the way, the people aren't aware that the rite that he talks about is an Old Norse pagan rite where they would bring in a boar and swear oaths on its bristles and then sacrifice it at Yule, the oaths that were important. And it's believed that this boar was related to the god Freyr because he rode on a boar, and so he was associated with boars. So in Oxford, at Oxford University, there is a college that has a roast boar's head as its Christmas feast every year, and they sing the boar's head carol, which I just gave you a verse of. So he's asking if it's connected, and I think it's possible it is, because more widely in medieval England, pork was the Christmas food. And in Scandinavia, as I say, they still have these marzipan pigs that they make for Christmas. And some people think, is this go back to this ancient pagan pig sacrifice that was for Christmas? Probably, maybe, but you can't know for sure. I'm afraid there's no evidence that can tie them directly because there's a lot of missing history in between.
Okay. All right. Dave Martell says, we're going to build a bog and the McPagans are going to pay for it. obviously paraphrasing Trump. I don't know which conflict he's referring to here, but thank you anyway for the paraphrase.
Good to hear from you, Big Dave Martell.
Yes, absolutely. Everyone should check out the Bizarre Archives episode of Millennial this year. It was a few days ago. It was very good. Black Pigeon Pilled says, greetings. Does W.G. Collingwood still enjoy standing within the Academy, given his involvement in the Viking Club? It seems Viking and Anglo-Saxon and even Byzantine have been pointlessly problematized. W.G. Collingwood.
I don't know about the Viking Club and Collingwood's involvement in them.
Okay. I did hear this, that the term Viking, that's getting negated as well. I didn't know about Byzantine, though.
Okay. That isn't for PC reasons. There's another reason for it, but I won't go into it now. It's a bit boring, but yeah.
Okay. Can you point to any studies as to why the Welsh, Bretons, and Cornish appear several hues darker than their ancient Anglo-Saxon adversaries?
I didn't know. This person has seen an Anglo-Saxon's complexion. Where did they see that? Where did they get? They got a photograph of them, have they? First off, I think that the darkness of the Cornish is massively over exaggerated. I live a stone's throw away from the Cornish border, and I know what Cornish people look like. There are occasionally people in Devon and Cornwall with skin as dark as the French. They have French DNA. That's why I would say they have. Like, everyone in England has a little bit of French DNA, or more. Some people have significantly more French DNA. So now this new paper says everyone's got a bit of French DNA. So I'd say if you must attribute complexion to one of the three ancestries, which, by the way, there's no reason you have to do that, because complexion can be selected for in the intervening centuries that have occurred. Then yeah, you could attribute that to the French, because the French are darker than the English, of course, being a southern people.
Or maybe those dark-skinned people in Cornwall and whatever, maybe they've just eaten a lot of cheddar.
Yeah, well, that would be in Somerset then.
Sorry, it reminds me of, yeah, it doesn't matter. All right, okay, how did you go from playing Sonic the Hedgehog to appearing on Millennial? What made you value your nation's heritage?
Well, a lot of things happened.
I should just say, I went from playing Sonic the Hedgehog to hosting Millennials, so it has happened, you know?
Everyone played Sonic the Hedgehog in the 90s, or they played Mario Brothers, or both. It's just like, I'm talking about when Sonic 1 came out when I was like 6 or 5 or something like that. I don't remember. So like, I was a child then. And what happened is I grew up. I guess it's a short answer. But yeah, I got into history. My grandfather was a graduate of Oxford, history in Oxford. And so was his wife, my grandmother. So both of them were history graduates. They actually met at Oxford University studying history. And he was later a teacher. And after the war. And I didn't really take much interest in history. Even in school, I thought my history teacher was an idiot. She told us that communism and fascism were the same. And I knew that wasn't true. So I thought I won't listen to much of what she says. So I don't regret that because she was dumb. But I did have another history teacher, actually, who was really clever bloke. He was actually a PhD, had a doctorate in history, but he was still teaching in secondary school, state school. So I was lucky to have him. But anyway, no, I just got into history reading in my spare time. I just studied media for my first degree, actually. After my first degree, I just got really into reading a lot, and I read and read and read, and I couldn't devour enough books. Suddenly I was just really into it. And a lot of them were in religion. And actually that's what interests me. I'm not really a typical historian who memorizes dates and battles and things, because that doesn't actually interest me a huge amount. What is my passion is religion and understanding the way that ideologies and beliefs affect behaviors and people over time, and how those change and what convinces people to change. That fascinates me. And so I naturally gravitated towards the topic of the conversion of the English people being English. And, I studied it so much that eventually I decided it's crazy. I spent years studying this and I have nothing to show for it. So I'm actually going to go and do a master's degree in it just to prove that I have done all this study for years. And after I finished my master's, I wasn't finished studying. So in the subsequent 11 years or whatever it's been since I finished my master's, I've just been studying history loads. I mostly paganism, but also other things, because I also find genetics really interesting for quite different reasons from the religion. But luckily for me, there's a bit of an overlap, because ancient genetics helps you understand when a new people come in. And when new people come in, new ideas come in. People would like to have you believe that ideas spread independently of people. But actually, while that is possible, especially in the modern age with the technology we have now, I think it's very difficult for that to happen. It's possible after the printing press is invented, but difficult. And most of the time when new ideas are spreading, you'll see that they're being spread by new people.
All right. Somebody on my awesome channel asked me, when will you enable Odyssey memberships? I'll have to look into that. I don't actually know what an Odyssey membership, what it does, and what it would, if it would cut off content from not like everyone else. I don't know if that would be a good idea. I think, and especially because people would just pirate the videos. You know, I know that this happens. It's very difficult to maintain a paywall. So I'm not sure, and I'm not sure that I would want to do that. You know. It's a difficult question. I'll have to look into Odyssey memberships and see what it actually does. All right. Okay, a question for you, Tom. Who is the artist for your illustrated book? The artwork is fantastic. Will you be creating more books like this?
The Spirit of You is by Christopher Steininger, who has the Sigur Press. I may work with him again on something one day. I don't know. We talked about the possibility, but I'm so busy with my videos. It's hard to fit anything else in at the moment. But yeah, he's a great artist, and he has his own YouTube channel and Odyssey channel as well, if you want to see it. Actually, the cartoon version of the book is on his channel, not on mine. And I also did another cartoon with him already. I'd done the second cartoon, which was called Sacred Apples, which is all about like all the different Indo-European myths involving the theft of apples. It was important and interesting.
All right. That does sound good. Okay. Dear Woz and Tom, this is from Insightful World. I know your love for folk horror and decent television from before 1995. I stumbled upon this channel on Odyssey full of great rips. Not my channel, by the way. Enjoy and Merry Christmas. And I think he's saying it's called Misty Isles. I'll just have a look at that. But I certainly love, everyone knows, I love British TV drama from before, Yeah, from before 1995. Yeah, that's probably a good cutoff, yeah. But especially from the 70s. And I know that Tom is also into that. We've talked about that on numerous occasions.
We had a whole millennial chat on it.
Yes, indeed. Yeah, okay. And it does look quite interesting. There's quite a lot of stuff there. So, yes, that's Misty Isles with an underscore between the two words. Okay, thank you for that recommendation. Okay, here's one. Burnsy, is Tom an MC1R carrier? His hair seemed redder in earlier videos. MC1R, it's obviously a gene.
I think everyone pretty much in the British Isles is a carrier because at least one copy. It's quite, you have to have two to have red hair, but like, I don't have, my prediction on my DNA test is that I'm more likely to be blonde than red haired. And it says I'm very unlikely to be red haired. So I was especially the sides of my beard do have a copperish tone. And it was a great surprise to me when I grew my beard out that was the case. Cause I'd spent so long bullying gingers in school that I didn't anticipate that I might have any, but it's actually quite normal for people from Britain to have blondish, like actually my hair is blondish brown, but then to have a slightly reddish tone to the beard is not uncommon. Whereas my wife is blonde, but her DNA thing says that she's more likely to be redhead than I am and less likely to be blonde than I am. Yet the prediction model is, you know, it's only a prediction. Like I'm not really blonde. She's more blonde than I am, but the prediction was that I would be more likely to be blonde. But our son is very blonde. He's got much blonder hair than either of us.
Oh, right. Lovely. Okay. Now, here's a big question. You can answer it as concisely as you like. Monty Fontaine asks, is out of Africa true? Also, are there any good human biology history books that aren't paused? Thanks, chaps.
The out of Africa theory probably is true. In depending on what you mean by the out of Africa theory, the original out of Africa theory is wrong because it's been disproven. The narrative of the time frame of it and the everything that about like you know the what's now favored is a multi dispersal model which includes hybridization with multiple hominids in different parts of the world. But it still means that the majority of our ancestry comes from a migration out of Africa. So in that sense, it's right. Books about human about population genetics, was it?
Yes.
Population genetics moves too quickly for any book to be relevant for more than a few months before it becomes outdated. So I wouldn't really recommend books that much. The only book that is any good on it is probably, I mean, the only mainstream books about it are one, Adam Rutherford's How to Argue with a Racist, which you shouldn't read because that's ridiculous, you know, crap. And the other one is David Reich's Who We Are and How We Got Here, which is is better, but probably quite outdated in many respects and now. And they're both left-wing. There's no right-wing book on it. But there are right-wing books on race and stuff from long ago, but they're completely outdated, so not really worth reading unless you're just curious about what people used to think. But
I think you've said this before, that a lot of our knowledge and understanding of these matters has been upended by the genome sequencing technology.
The genomic revolution, yeah. Because we had DNA tests in the 90s, but it was crap then. There was a lot of contamination and you couldn't really look at very much of the DNA. But since 2015, it's just gone completely different. It's a new science, basically. Like the risk of contamination is much less. The cost of testing is less, so they can use more samples. More samples means more reliable data. It's just a different thing altogether. Like, I don't really care about any DNA studies from before 2015 because they're not worth looking at.
All right. Okay, Dave Martell comes back and says, Merry Yule, Brother Tom. The folk are all very proud of you. Hails and blessings to your family. Hail to our glorious ancestors. Hail to the high holy gods. And then he says an acronym, but I'm not sure what it refers to, so I don't want to read it out just in case it's something a bit too base for Britain. Okay, and Noticer-in-Chief says, great content, thank you both. Thank you very much. And, okay, and Black Pigeon Pilled, does wassailing derive from some... What wassailing? Does it derive from some pagan practice or fraternal orders circa 19th century? And is it associated with Yuletide?
Yes, I think it definitely is associated with Yuletide. And yes, I think it is Anglo-Saxon pagan origin. I've done a video on wassailing and everything's explained there. And I went to two different wassailings here in the West Country and interviewed the wassailers. And I explained the etymology of the word. And based on the etymology and on the historic attestations of the word and its context within toasting ceremonies, I would say that very likely is of pagan origin, especially the idea of singing to the trees to make them fruitful. That is very much a pagan thing to do, isn't it? To go and sing to a tree to try and make it produce more apples. So I'd say, and then the fact that it's called wassailing and the word wassail is an Anglo-Saxon toast. It's like saying cheers in Anglo-Saxon, basically. So, there's no, can I prove it 100%? No, can't prove it because we'd have to find a record of it in pagan times. And of course we don't have records of the pagan times much, but we do have records from near contemporary to the pagan times of the term wassail being described as an Anglo-Saxon toast. And its use in the context of a mythological pagan figure, Hengist, descended of the god Woden. So from that, I think if I had to bet my life on it, I'd say wassailing is pagan.
Okay. All right. Reclaim Your Neighborhood says, I saw one of your YouTube videos about the Aryan invasion. Is it your opinion that the Hindu gods are actually depictions of ancient Aryans? I've noticed artistic depictions of their gods appear to have lighter skin tones.
No, gods are gods, not humans. I don't believe in that euhemerism. I'm very scornful of euhemerism, which is an atheistic or Christian propaganda to reduce gods to humans. The gods of the Aryans would originally have been... the Aryans originally would have been not... I mean, they mixed with all the peoples wherever they went, but we know that their ancestry originates in Europe. So at some point, they would have been like modern, they would have looked like Europeans. But as they spread into Asia, they, you know, mix with other peoples. There are no very early depictions of the god. So you haven't seen anything close to an Aryan depiction of the god, of any god. The Aryan invasion occurred in 1500 BC. I'm not sure what the oldest Hindu idol is, but it's not really very close to there. And some Indian nationalists will tell you that there's a depiction of Shiva from the IVC culture, but that is not true. There is a depiction of a seated figure with horns from the IVC culture. There is no way of telling if that is Shiva or not. It's not Shiva. It's just a seated figure with horns.
All right. That's quite a forceful answer there. Dave Martell asks, Sonic, true pagans played Golden Axe.
I played Golden Axe.
I'm not familiar. This isn't. I don't know.
It was mostly an arcade only. It was an arcade game in the late 80s, early 90s. But it was available there was a Mega Drive version. Americans would call it a Genesis, I believe. The Mega Drive was the British name for the Genesis. It was a sort of sword and fantasy, magic and fantasy thing. You could play as a blonde woman with big tits. A big barbarian dude or a little dwarf with an axe. It was cool.
Yeah, I've just found the cover for it. It does look very cool. Yeah. Indeed, Genesis was the America. I think Mega Drive was a better name than Genesis.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, so it sounds cool.
All right. Sorry, I'm not familiar with that particular game, but I did play others that I've talked about before, so I won't go into it now. Okay, who did STJ do his DNA test with? Are some worse than others, or do they add 10% of something just to spite the bigots?
I won't say who I did it with, but I know I've tested with different... I know from family and friends who have tested with different ones, and I can tell you, like, they are... None of them are going to especially, like, spike your test. Wouldn't worry about that. Some... There are... none of the big ones are especially bad for privacy concerns, providing you go to the privacy section once of your profile and, you know, make the settings private. Make sure that you don't allow them to share the DNA. Make sure that you don't allow them to share your details, because you have to actually do the settings properly. And then you can't complain if you've given them permission to share stuff, if they do that. The accuracy is really very dependent on your ancestry. But because the biggest market in the world for genetic ancestry tests is from people of Northwest European descent, the big ones are all pretty good for people from Northwest Europe. That's the good news. You know, if you're Indian and you want to like get a real good breakdown of like how much is Gujarati and how much Bengali or whatever, some of them aren't very good at that because they don't have a good enough sample of breaking down internal ancestry within Southeast Asia or within South Asia. But I'm guessing most of you are like white people, and I wouldn't think there's a massive difference. If you're someone from Britain and you don't want to know, you already know you're like 100% British. You don't care about knowing that. You want to know how much ancestry do I have from Devon? How much do I have from Renfrewshire or whatever? Then I believe the best one is not, it's best not to use like ancestry.com or 23andMe, but there's another one which does a really, really good sub breakdown of county by county. I think it's Living DNA. I can't remember now. But yeah, they are much better at that sub-regional breakdown. But
I'll have to look at that, because my one on 23andMe says that most of my DNA comes from London. And
I wouldn't take it too seriously with 23andMe sub-regional breakdown's not great because it conflates cities. So for example, I've got no ancestors from Bristol, but I've got quite a few from around Somerset, and it just calls them all Bristol. Because people from Bristol are generally descended from people from the surrounding countryside, right? So it calls Somerset ancestry Bristol ancestry, which is, you know, an urban centric sort of thing to do. I guess they're aiming at urbanites or something. I don't know. But I can't remember the name. I think it was Living DNA that does this really good sub-regional breakdown in the British Isles. But if you have ancestry from outside the British Isles, I don't think that particularly a good service for you. Maybe, I don't know. I have actually done a big post on Telegram about this before. You should look at that.
Okay. All right. Question from me. Do you ever listen to The Smiths? I feel like their lyrics relating to existential dread and life in Northern England would jive well with you. I'm a fan myself. Well, I like How Soon Is Now. And I like Morrissey's recent stuff, and I like This Charming Man. There are a few songs that I like by The Smiths, but I'm not generally into them because it's just a bit dry for me. You know, I do like dark music, like brooding music, but it's more like more electronic. OMD is more my kind of thing than The Smiths. But I mean, they're clearly really talented. Sorry, Tom.
Cemetery Gates is a good song.
I don't know that one.
That was a good one. Good guitar. My old band supported the Polecats, and Bob Borman was the guitarist for Morrissey. And so he was the guitarist for the Polecats, because I used to be in rockabilly bands. So I was acquainted with some people who were acquainted with Morrissey. And
Right. Wow. That's a small world, really, isn't it? It's amazing when you find out these connections. Burnsy says, I would just like to say thank you to Tom for all of the great content and opening the door on paganism to me. It was not something that was discussed in much more than a quiet side note of history in my youth. That's a nice message there.
Thank you.
And then there's a sort of an easy question for us to end with. Not necessarily easy, but interesting. Inso asks the following. If you could, what would you correct Jordan Peterson on, since it sounds like you have the same interest?
Actually, I don't watch a lot of Jordan Peterson stuff, so I can't really give a really good answer to that. I'm aware that he dodges a lot of important things. Like, he doesn't actually, he won't speak up for the value of collective identity. Like, collective identity is important. No man's an island, and you can't have an authentic identity that you created completely out of nothing. It needs to be based on the reality of who you are, and who you are is determined, you know, scientifically speaking, you know, maybe like 60% by your genes, which you inherit from your ancestors, and 40% from your culture, which you inherit from your ancestors also. So you are a part of that. You can't divorce yourself from that and be this, you know, individual unit or whatever they want to imagine that doesn't exist, in my opinion. So that would be my principal objection to him.
Yeah, that I would say the same thing. And it's not just that he avoids the matter of collective identity. He actively discourages it. He actively says that this is not something that should matter to anyone. Well, it's specifically white people. And I think that's absolutely disgusting. And he should be ashamed of himself. I think he's a traitor and a liar and a charlatan. On that matter, if on no other matters, he's definitely on that one. So somebody asked me what to guess the beats per minute, the speed of your Christmas tree lights. But unfortunately, the Christmas tree lights, the speed seems to vary. So I can't put, I would say just now it's like, I think every 3 seconds, but there it goes, speed. It's an impossible question. Impossible question. So, all right. Well, I guess we can wrap it up there. So
this has been fun.
Yeah. Thank you very much. I'm going to be back in about 25 minutes with Scott Mannion. But in the meantime, Tom, survive the jive. Thank you for appearing on Millennial.
Thank you for having me, Woz. It's a pleasure as always. Good Yule to you and everyone of your listeners, followers, watchers.
Okay, great. Thank you. I'll see you all very soon. Bye-bye for now.
We hope you're enjoying Millennial. The show must go on, but it needs your help. There are many ways to make a cash donation. Find all of these at millennial.com/donate. Your kindness will be warmly appreciated. Millennial amounts to 3 months of work for the vile blogger. Please help him continue. Until next time, enjoy the show and spread the word.